Hi, everyone. Welcome to an exciting new episode of the ENTF project. This is something very unique that Karthik and I have done. We have David Steinberg on the show, and he needs no introduction. But if you just watched our introduction video that we played before this, you'll see that he's very accomplished. He's a very accomplished screenwriter. And this is going to be a super fun interview. We have some fun twists coming for you at the end. And this is the first interview we've done that for. So yeah, super excited to have David on the show. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So let me dive right into the first question, right? We asked this with all of our experts, and selfishly for Karthik and I, this is something that we like asking because we're both in the same position right now. So what was your first job, and what is the thing that you learned in your first job that you carry with you till today?
Well, my brother was a plumber and he had a plumbing company. And so in the summers when I was in high school, I would always do plumbing. So my first job was a plumber, but not sometimes I would go with a handyman that would go repair like your toilet broke. But a lot of times I was working with the construction crew. We were laying down new pipes for construction projects. But I did it every single summer, even through college. I was still doing it. And it made me want to do something else. That was the first lesson I learned. But also, I still know how to do that. So when in our house, when we have a problem with the toilet or the sink or something, I can usually fix it on my own. So it's a good skill to have. It's something you should teach your children how to fix their own plumbing.
Yeah. You know, that's very funny that you say that plumbing is like the most expensive thing, I feel like, and something still they have. So what is one thing that you carried from that plumbing career, like in terms of the work ethic and everything that you carry with you into the job that you are in today?
Well, I think it certainly teaches you that, you know, the value of labor and especially manual labor. I mean, plumbing is, it's a skilled labor. So it's not just like digging a dish, obviously. So there's more to it than that. But, you know, it's long, hard work, and working 8 hours a day and overtime, it just makes you realize that you have a lot of respect for people who work with their hands. And so I think it's just about when I was a lawyer after I went to law school. And so I've had mostly white collar type jobs my whole life, but having that background where you're used to working with blue collar workers, it certainly gives you a respect for people who do any kind of job.
Yeah, kind of makes you empathize with everyone around and not take any profession for granted, right?
Absolutely.
But it's interesting you went to law school. So what law did you major in law school?
Right. So I grew up on the East Coast. I grew up in Connecticut, and I didn't know that the entertainment business was a real thing. No one came to my high school and said, go be a writer. So when I was a senior in college, I applied to law school, as people do. I didn't really know much about it. If you're good at arguing, when you're growing up, they say, oh, you should go to law school. So I thought, oh, okay, I guess I should do that. And without really thinking too much about it, I just found myself 3 years later, I graduated from law school. I did well, and I clerked for a judge for a year, and then I worked for 2 years in Atlanta in a law firm and 1 year in New York. And I was doing litigation, but I started doing entertainment litigation. And that's how I got first exposed to the entertainment business. And what I realized practicing law for 4 years was that I didn't like it. The most important thing is not that I didn't like what I was doing, it's that I didn't what I was trying to get to. So if I had succeeded and stuck it on, you can imagine paying your dues to try to get to some higher position where there would be all these rewards. That makes sense. Okay, you make a partner at a law firm. If that was a dream situation, then it makes sense to work hard for 8 to 10 years to get to there. But if you don't want to do the job that you're trying to get to, then you know you need to get out of the career altogether. And what I saw was that the law had changed so much, even when I was doing it, that the sort of idea that you could just kind of hang back and play golf or, you know, rest on your laurels and make all this money and you would have all this free time, it didn't really exist anymore. Maybe that used to exist. Maybe that was just a fantasy all along. I don't really know. But the partners were working on the weekends too. The idea that you were working insane hours when you were in your 20s and 30s, and then you got to this point where you could just make a lot of money and do something that you loved and then have your weekends and your family time to yourself, it didn't exist because these partners were working on the weekends all the time too. And so it slowly became clear to me that I didn't want to get to the job that was the goal. And so that's when I decided to apply to film school.
So how much of the skill set you learned in law school or working under judges were you able to transfer to your screenwriting career? Because the premise is this. Oh, okay. Got it. Because I was thinking probably you were in court settings or mock court settings where you were like the defendant and all of the different scenarios that go, and maybe that serves something as a transferable skill to your screenwriting career.
And that sounds more like if I was in a law firm like on TV, In a real law firm, you're not going to court and saying, I object. You're just like doing document reviews and you're sitting in a room with no windows. The idea that you're like getting all this fantastic experience in a courtroom doesn't really happen. So I would say the main thing is that there's an entire body of knowledge that's completely useless. I mean, I know about torts and contracts, constitutional law. I've forgotten a lot of it over the years, but that doesn't really come into play at all. So really what you're talking about is these sort of like more esoteric qualities of, you know, having a legal framework to analyze things or discipline of being able to write. That's one thing that carries over. I was never much of a writer. If I had to do a 5-page paper at college, I was like, oh no, how am I going to get 5 pages done? After being a lawyer, if they said, hey, we need to write a 30-page brief and it's due tomorrow, I'd say, okay, I start writing. And now as a writer, the idea of writing 100 pages is not daunting. I know how to break it up into smaller parts. I know how to get things done in a more disciplined way. And I think that's from legal training. It's also possibly just being an adult and not being a slacker. So I don't know, any training probably would have taught you the same lesson about how to like get things done on time so you don't get fired. But as far as like legal reasoning and being logical, I mean, sure, it's a chicken and egg problem. Is that because I went to law school or is that the skills that I had that got me into law school? I don't know. It's like, they're not bad skills to have. It's not like I have a leg up on all the other writers because I went to law school.
We spoke over the phone, David. You mentioned something that was very interesting. You said there is no definite path or a path that's already written out for a screenwriter to take to be successful.
Right.
So I want to ask a question based on that, right? I see that you're giving back with the West Side Writers Group that you have, where you're working with a group of writers to teach them how to do screenwriting. So say, you know, and you took a very, you know, untraditional path to screenwriting, like with filming and with your law career and then, you know, screenwriting. It seems like actually I wouldn't even say untraditional. I think you took one of the unique paths, I guess, if there's no path, right? So, you know, so say there is a writer in your group that has a story that he or she has written. What is the next thing that they have to do?
I don't know. That's the problem. No one knows. I mean, there's best practices, but what I was telling you on the phone is so strange about our business, and maybe it's unique. Maybe there's other businesses that are similar. Maybe it's the same in tech or whatever. I don't know. But a strange thing about Hollywood is that there's no defined way to do it. So if you want to be a dentist, you don't have to ask, you don't have to find a dentist and say, hey, can I pick your brain? How did you get to be a dentist? I'm really curious about this. They'll say, what are you talking about? I went to dental school. It's just to be a lawyer, a dentist, an accountant, any of the normal traditional jobs. I don't know if normal is the wrong word, but there's a very specific way of doing that thing that it's not just tried or true. It's the only way of doing it because that's how you acquire those skills and that's how you become licensed to do that thing. If you want to be a plumber, you have to go to be get your plumbing license. Whatever it is, there's a very specific way of doing it. So if you want to be a writer in Hollywood or an actor or director, no one tells you how to do it. I went to film school. That's one possible way, and that's nothing is guaranteed. And the reason why it's so hard to define how to do it is because it's such a competitive business that, for example, in the Writers Guild, there's only 11,000 members. Only half of them earn income every year. Some of them are just, you know, trying and don't make any money, but there's only a few thousand people that do it. So it's comparable to like, not, I'm not sort of trying to glorify it, but the number is, as far as pure statistics, it's equivalent to like being in the NFL, the National Football League. I'm not saying that screenwriters and professional football players are the same talent level, but it's the same number of people doing it professionally. So if you say, well, hey, I want to be a professional football player, it's like, okay, well, you have to like play in high school and college and whatever, and you have to be the best of the best of the best. The thing about Hollywood is it's a combination of talent and the ratio between the two, no one knows. It could just be a lot of luck. When you break in and you're successful, you think there's a high ratio of talent, but it's really not clear. It's certainly like they're going to sound a little bit facetious, but one of the best things you can do to break into Hollywood is to be really, really good friends with someone who's already in Hollywood. If one of the tried and true ways is to have your parents be very successful in Hollywood, that is an excellent way to break in. But if you're just someone who doesn't have any connections, you have to write a screenplay with whether it's television or film. Essentially, you know, I'll stop, you know, joking around here. Point is that you have to write something. It has to be amazing. And then you have to get it to people who can help you. And how do you get it to people? No one knows. You have to get it to a manager or an agent. But people are not bending over backwards. Oh, please let me read your script. There's 100,000 scripts registered every year in Hollywood. If you live in LA and you go to any Starbucks on any corner, there's people writing screenplays. When you walk into that Starbucks, everyone has a laptop. If you go and snoop around and look at what they're writing, it's a screenplay all over Los Angeles. So the competition level is just insane. It's even worse trying to be an actor. But because you're dealing with that level of competition, the industry sort of can afford to have there be no path to success, or just have it be some combination of, you know, being in the right place at the right time. Going to film school is one way to meet people, to make those connections. I met her in film school. She was a young producer that got me to a lawyer who got me to an agent who read my script, wanted to represent me. That's how I got representation. We sent the script out, didn't sell, wrote another one, didn't sell, third one, that one sold. That's how I broke in. That's just my story. How I did it is completely useless to anyone else. But it's, you know, big picture, you have to write something really good and you have to get it into the hands of people who can help you.
It seems like networking is a big part of it, right? Right. Like communicating, networking, making connections.
Networking, yes, but networking is like a kind of a dirty connotation in Hollywood. It kind of implies that you're like going to cocktail parties and like giving people business cards and stuff. It's not like that. And in fact, if you try to do that in Hollywood, people will laugh at you and be like, oh God, he's trying to network. It's got to be more organic. It's about making relationships with people at your own level. Trying to like, I'll give you an example. There was a very big, I won't name his name, but a very big writer producer who has a huge, huge show on TV. And as you know, we're on strike right now and people are walking the picket line. And you've got people who are at the bottom of the barrel and the top of the barrel. And you've got these huge writers. And so you have sometimes, unfortunately, some people show up at the picket line and they bother them and say, hey, Mr. So-and-so, I'm such a huge fan. Can I give you my business card? I'd love to send you my script. Could you read it for me and like tell me what you think? I'd love to work for you. Just tell me what. That is so cringe. You don't want to do that. You don't want to try to network with people who are one step above you, let alone 10 steps above you. We're talking about networking. We're talking about organically building relationships with people at your own level. If you're an assistant, if you're just trying to break in, meet other people at your level that are just trying to break in. Help each other. Join a writer's group. And then try to use those relationships as you all lift each other up.
So every field is going through innovation, right? Everyone's trying to do different to stand above the rest of the competition. I see that happening in tech. I see that happening in healthcare, all of it. How innovative can you get with screenplay and screenwriting? And at what point do you think I over-engineered this in making it too abstract that people will not understand the concept that I'm trying to communicate through my screenwriting?
Well, it sounds like that kind of innovation sounds more like directing skill. Like if you are, you know, the Wachowskis and creating bullet time to make the Matrix, that sort of innovation and like way of showing things on screen using visual effects and stuff is going to be cool and amazing, and that's a great way to do it. But the story is like the thousands of years old structure. I think trying to like come in and say, I'm going to change the way Hollywood tells stories is, you know, it's people do it. It's like people with hubris come in and say, you know, I'm this tech bro from Silicon Valley, and I'm going to come in and tell you how to like, you guys are doing everything wrong. And I'm going to like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm writing an app that's going to like write the screenplay for you. It's like, okay, settle down. That we don't need those people. We don't need AI to write the screenplays for us or to step in for the creative people. I mean, we can have a philosophical debate whether you think that pure creativity can be done by AI. I think we would, on our side, argue that it can't. So trying to replace the actors and writers and directors with algorithms and whatnot is not something we're in favor of. But just the general idea that people come and say, I don't like the way the business of Hollywood is being run. I'm going to like change everything. Those people come in, they crash and burn, then they leave. And I guess the counter argument is Netflix. But aside from Netflix, it's a mature industry. They've been making films for over 100 years, and the television business isn't young either. They've been making television for 75 years. So the way in which stories are told and film and television is produced is basically the way it's been done for a long time. And I don't think people are very receptive to like disruption of the industry in that sense. Innovation in terms of, you know, visual effects and things like that are always going to be cool. But coming and saying, you know, you guys keep telling stories with a beginning, middle, and end. We're not going to do that anymore. I mean, you can make a Christopher Nolan film and have it be like, it's going to be told backwards. Okay, great. And like, you know, if you can pull it off, then you're Christopher Nolan. Good job. But otherwise, there's nothing wrong with telling a story in the normal order of beginning, middle, and end. That is going to be just fine. But the point is that when you're writing a screenplay, it's about having an interesting idea that you haven't seen before and having characters that you haven't seen before. It's not about like telling a story in a way that no one's ever imagined. It's just about, oh, that's a character that I like, and then I want to see what they're going to do with this problem they're encountering. How are they going to overcome this obstacle? And having it being an engaging storytelling. So.
You know, Karthik touched a little bit on his last question about over-engineering things, right? Like, you know, as not in terms of over-engineering, but as now that, like, not, and not even as someone who's a new screenwriter, as someone like you, who's a seasoned screenwriter, how much do you think of the other aspects of filmmaking, like direction and production, do you think you should know to make your script more successful or more acceptable by someone?
I think it's really important. Can you just write a story? Can you just come to Hollywood, don't know anything about how to make film or television and just write a great story? Sure, you can do that. You can read a book on the structure of a screenplay, and if you're a good storyteller, it's great. But what is helpful in really crafting a story and taking it to the next level is understanding how it's going to be made. If you've been on set before, that's an asset. If you understand what the other people do in the production process, that's only going to make your screenplay better. So I'll give you an example. If you're a lot of times in comedy, action, horror, a lot of genre things, you'll see what's called a set piece. Set piece is like the big scene, the big trailer moment. It used to just be a big set. That's why they call it a set piece. But now it's like the big, huge scene. A lot of times, in order to make that scene really super funny or super scary or super any emotion, is to escalate the tension, escalate the comedy through physicality. So what do I mean by that? It's like you could just have your character saying some stuff and you could have, you know, someone slip on the banana peel or they can get a pie in their face. Okay, that's going to get you this level of comedy or horror or whatever. But then what? How do you escalate that? And escalating that involves you having a mental knowing, how is the camera going to capture this? How is the camera going to, what is, now the set doesn't exist. You're just making it up in your mind. But you say, so a bad example is someone gets a pie in their face and then they stumble backwards. Well, what's behind them? I don't know, because I can't imagine it because I've never been on a set before. Oh, well, what if there's a door, a revolving door? And obviously I'm making this up on the top of my head. And now they're spinning through the door. But then, you know, something crashes down and a bar goes in the door and it stops the door and it crashes through the glass. So you're imagining the props and the set design and how the camera is going to move and how that's going to be filmed. And and what are we showing? Are we showing like a thing teetering off the edge and the camera's up here and then we're going to reveal that it falls? Or are we going to show the thing is going to fall without revealing it and it's going to be a surprise? So that's editing. So are we showing the thing that falls first and then we're like, oh no, it's going to fall? Or are we showing the person and then the thing surprises them? And so it's two different emotions if you show it first or if you show it second. That's editing. So if you've never sat down with an editor before and seen how editing works, it's harder to do all of that. So when you get to the upper level of your career and you're really, you know, at the top of your game when it comes to writing, you're incorporating all these other production aspects and you know the entire process from beginning to end, from pre-visualization, from set building to casting and everything production to actually producing a film or television show, and then the post-production of sound and edit and whatever, and like how can you cut it together with music and whatever. If you have all those skills, it's just more skills and it's going to make your screenplay better. You don't have to get all fancy and be like, and then we hear this, you know, sound effect, and then this, you don't have to deal with that, but knowing that stuff is going to make the writing elicit more emotion.
You know, it sounds like a very complicated process, right? Writing in general, like thinking about all of these different aspects of things, the set design, like you said, sometimes I'm watching a TV show and you know, season one ends on a cliffhanger and season two is like 2 years later. I'm like, oh my God, why is it taking them so long? But there's so much that goes into it, including the writing, the direction, the set design and everything. So how long does it usually take for a screenwriter to write a movie?
Okay, so there's a lot of different distribution models. So if you're talking about, it seems like what you're talking about is like a Netflix show or a stream show. So the problem with a Netflix show is, well, maybe it's not a problem, is that as we all know, they all come out at the same time. You binge them. So you watch The Night Agent on Netflix. All 8 episodes came out on the first day, right?
Yeah.
But you have to make all 8 episodes. And so you have to, of an hour-long show, shoots for 7 to 10 days. But there's obviously the pre-production of writing the scripts and that casting, whatever. Long story short, you could probably do those 8 episodes in 6 months to a year, depending on visual effects. But the first episode will be done sooner than the last episode, right? Because you're shooting that in order. So if you're doing a TV show that's on network television like ABC, or CBS, or you're doing NCIS, the first episode comes out in September, and maybe they started shooting that in July. But when that's coming out, they're shooting episode 5.
I think
22 of them. So they're writing episode and they're shooting episode 5 while episode 1's airing. So network television, the thing that's been in existence for 75 years, is typically 22 episodes over a 40-week production cycle. And they're making them as you're watching them, because it takes a long time to make them, but oh, it's an assembly line, sort of. So when that finale comes out in May, that 22nd episode, that has just got finished, could be the week before. They just finished it because they were running behind, and they finally got the final cut and the sound mix together and aired a couple days later. So that's the traditional model. And then that's why in September, another episode, it's like the cliffhanger happens in May, but in September, after hiatus, the next episode airs. So it's only a few months later. So it's possible to make hour-long television, half-hour television, even with a small hiatus, it's possible to make the seasons go 3 months apart. If you do 22 episodes, 3 months later, you can have the next 22 start. It's not that hard, and people have been doing it for decades. The problem is, if you are the Netflix executive, you say, I want all of my episodes to air on the same day. They don't all air on September 15th, because that's only when the first one's available. Now they're all airing on the May 15th, proverbial. That's why also Netflix only does 8 episodes, or 10 or 13 at most, because if you're going to make 22 of them, it takes a whole year. And they're not going to wait a whole year for the 22 to be done and then release them all. So the point is that you can only release them on the last day, not the first day, right? Because of that, so now Netflix has to wait for them to come out, and then they have to see, well, do people watch it? And they take their time, and they say, oh, you know what? This is a big hit. We're going to renew it. Let's do more. Now you got at least another year. And that's for a show with no visual effects. If you're doing The Witcher or Stranger Things, anything with a lot of visual effects, then it's 2 years between seasons, because they have to wait for them all to come out, make a decision on whether to make more, start making them, finish making them, then release. And by the way, there's one more thing with Netflix that adds an extra 4 months, is that they have to be translated into every language in the world.
Right.
So Netflix releases them simultaneously in all countries. So they have there's post-production, and then there's a 4 month period of doing the dubs, the foreign language dubs. So that's why it takes so long. Obviously, if you're doing NCIS, they're not dubbing it into languages simultaneously. They can do that later. So that's the difference between network television release schedule and a streaming release schedule. But I don't remember the original question. I'm just explaining how distribution works.
So what I'm curious about on network television, and you talk about episodes come, and then parallelly you start going for your other schedules for shooting other episodes. Is there a scope for getting customer feedback in terms of the user liking what is being shown to him? Or is it bound script for the whole series? If you had planned for 14 episodes, but for a season, you said, okay, this is bounded, I'm just going to commit to the script. Or is there scope for improvement based on how the audience has received it?
Absolutely. And that is the network model from day one, is that there's Nielsen ratings. So there's people, they know on September 15th, when episode 1 airs, how many people watched it? What's the feedback? And even though you're shooting episode 5, say, for example, so there's no, you can't do anything about the other 4 that you've already made, but you can course correct. So I'll give you a classic example. Happy Days in the 70s was originally about the Richie Cunningham, the Ron Howard character and his parents. And then there was a side character, the Fonz. But the Fonz character got such a big fan reaction, they retooled it in the middle of the season and said, oh, this should be about this guy. And it became about a different character. And so you can course correct on a network show right in the middle of the season. You can certainly do it in season 2. Seinfeld, everyone remembers that Seinfeld season 1 was not a ratings hit. It was not anything. And then it sort of took off in season 2 as the format changed. You know, if you remember in the early Seinfelds, it always started with him doing stand-up comedy. In the later seasons, they're like, no one cares about that. Let's just have it be an episode of TV. And they stopped showing him doing stand-up comedy. So certainly in network television, you can course correct. In a streaming model, you cannot course correct. You can, because you're releasing the whole thing, and it's either did you like it or not, and they can focus group or test it or whatever and say, well, we're going to renew you for season 2 and we want to do something different this season. But it's pretty much all or nothing, and there's no feedback until it's too late.
You know, Witcher is one of my favorite shows, and I'm always complaining about how they release very few, they release seasons too far apart. Now I'm going to be more kinder, I guess. So
it's not necessarily the best model. It's just that's the way they do it at Netflix, yeah. And it remains to be seen whether that is a model that is superior. I think most people argue that it's not, and if you look at like Netflix moving towards ad-based revenue, they're starting to maybe realize that the binge model isn't necessarily the best way to go. And there's a couple of examples. If you look at HBO, I know it's now Max, but when HBO releases things, they always release them one at a time. So like the shows that people talk about, Succession, The Last of Us, White Lotus, people are talking about it for a while. It's like, oh, have you seen Succession? Oh my God, last episode's amazing. And they're like, I can't wait to see what happens next week. So it's like watching network television, but it's HBO. And then people are talking about it for longer. When you talk about a show like The Witcher, like season three came out, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago. No one's talking about it anymore. It's over. Came out, people talked about it for a weekend, and then it's over. And it loses that water cooler conversation that could get the rate, because a lot of times, unless you're in the business or you're a real fanatic, you're not like, oh, this is coming out on August 15th. I need to mark my calendar and watch it that day. Most people are like, oh, I heard there's a really good show. I'll give you an example. Shrinking on Apple. Great show. Really funny, really well done. Most people have never heard of it. And I tell them, oh, you should check out the show. I don't know if you have Apple, but go check it out. And they check it out, but it's too late. I mean, it got renewed, so it's fine. But if you discovered it and said, oh my God, that show is amazing, and the ratings went up 6 months later, it's too late. They've either canceled the show or renewed it. So they need immediate feedback, which is not necessarily conducive to a show finding its audience. So like that word of mouth, there's just not enough time in streaming to have word of mouth make a difference.
So how much of a show getting renewed season after season, and say, for example, a show doesn't get renewed after a season, is that attributed to the screenplay not being engaging enough, or will it be attributed to the production company not doing enough marketing for spreading the word out to your average Joe, who should be aware of such and such a show existing on one of your streaming agents or one of your cable next?
Well, I mean, the good thing about Hollywood is that when things are a hit, the creative people get the credit. They don't necessarily get all the money, but they get credit for the success of it. But when things are a failure, no one really takes the blame. That's kind of a good, they don't say, well, it must suck. The writer did a bad job. They don't say that. They usually say, well, you know, we don't know the numbers. It's like the network canceled the show and like bad decision. But, you know, that I love that show. It was so good. I don't know why it got canceled. And they don't tell you why it got canceled. So no one really takes the blame. And they don't say it's because it was bad. You could say, well, they didn't even market it. No one ever knew about that show. They should have spent more money telling people about it. But it's really hard to pinpoint who's at fault when shows get canceled. A lot of times it just like everything gets canceled eventually. So, you know, we had a show on Netflix called No Good Nick. That was a show my wife and I created, and we did 20 episodes, and then we didn't get a second season. You know, people don't say like, wow, you guys failed. People are like, you got a show on there. That's a huge success. You didn't get two seasons. No one is blaming us and saying, well, you know, you must have done something wrong. They're just like, stupid Netflix. Those guys don't know what they're doing. People blame the network. They don't blame the creative people.
You know, throughout the course of your career, right, you've learned so much, right? Starting from when you started out in screenwriting to where you are now. What is one thing that you've had to move forward in your career?
Well, in the very beginning, I had to unlearn the keeping track of my time. When I was a lawyer, you have to like bill by the hour. And it took a while for me to not pay attention to my time. But I think it's about following ideas and just letting your creativity flow and not try to be results oriented. I think in most industries, you're trying to accomplish a certain goal. And I think that translates into writing towards trying to like smart a marketplace, or say, well, you know what, this movie was just a hit. Let's do something like that. Or, you know what the formula is. If we just do a show that's like this, then that'll be successful. And those never work. You can't duplicate other people's success. And trying to be results oriented, which is a good discipline to have in most industries, doesn't really work. So for me, it's about just pursuing ideas I find interesting or characters that I like, regardless of whether I think they're marketable. And like I don't know, who would even watch this? How is this going to sell? You can't let that stop. You just have to get it out, outline it, write it, and see where it goes. And then you don't know if it's marketable or not. You know, that's up to the marketplace. So it's like, it's obviously, it's a tough industry because we're ever doing things on spec. We're sort of creating product that we don't know if there's a market for. It's like, imagine if like, you know, GM would make a car and say, we don't know if anyone wants this kind of car, but we're going to try and see what happens. And, oh, no one wants it? Oh, well, we just wasted $1 billion. So we do our research and marketing after we make the product.
I'm ridiculous, that's the only way of doing it.
No, so I guess say I want to write a screenplay, or I've written something, right? What I did ask you a question about, what do I do next and where do I take it and everything. What is the literature available out there for me to look up to, like, you know, learn about so I can make my screenplay better without having you know, experience of production design and set and being on set and everything? Is there anything out there that I...
Well, there's a lot of resources. I mean, obviously there's traditional film schools that you can go to. That's a big financial investment. But aside from film school, there's just tremendous resources on the internet, whether it's, you know, I wouldn't recommend Reddit. Those are kind of like crazy people. Believe it or not, the screenwriting community in Twitter is actually really good and pretty nurturing. And like, if you like follow a bunch of screenwriters that you like, say, oh, this person wrote this show, I like that show, I will follow them on Twitter. People really try to pay back and pay forward their knowledge. And you can learn a lot just from people discussing mistakes and advice on Twitter from people who are in the screenwriting business. So that's one place. There's a lot of, you know, there's a whole cottage industry of like people who aren't really in the business who try to like sell their services. Like, here's how you make it in Hollywood. I don't recommend that because it's like people who are not working in Hollywood telling you how to make it in Hollywood. Yeah. You would think that would be like an instant red flag, but it's a huge business. So there's also books on screenwriting, of course, but I think being part of the community is really the key. Whether if you're able to be in Los Angeles or New York in person, that's better. But if you're not, just being part of the online community and learning from other writers who are doing what you're doing and really like leaving your ego at the door, because a lot of people come in like, I'm going to write the screenplay and sell for $1 million. You're like, okay, great. We've never heard that before. And everyone's just kind of dumb on that person. But if you're just like, hey, I'm here to learn. Let me give you an example. If you went on Twitter right now and said, I've just written my first screenplay. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just here to learn. I'm very humble. Can someone just point me in the right direction of some great resources? If you just post that, you would get so many nice responses. People would not make fun of you. They'd be like, here's what I recommend. You should read this book. Oh, here's a great seminar you could take. Oh, here's a website to look at. People would be very nice to you, assuming they saw it.
So a question that I, for one of your previous answers you gave around screenwriting and feature films, and when you split screenplay into the beginning, the middle, and the end, and sometimes when I consume content, and one of my favorite shows that had its last season was a severe letdown. I don't want to name the show, but I was like, it had a great start. It had a great midline, but towards the end, they did not know what to do with it, and it just fell flat. So is a communication gap between what the screenwriter wrote and what got adapted as screenplay in terms of direction? Or like, for example, in a feature film, sometimes I'm like, the starting was great. I understood where this was going. I was hoping this would go this way, but it just fell flat and the narration was pretty linear, or it fell flat in between and it just got confused and I don't know what ended up happening at the end of it.
Well, for a feature film, there's a million things that can go wrong. It's a miracle when anything turns out good because there's so many people involved. And like, for example, you can write a screenplay and it can be like really well structured and hopefully it's got a great ending, whatnot. But wait, but if you don't have the $20, $40, $100 million to make it yourself, you're at the mercy of the person paying to make it. So when you sell that screenplay to Paramount or Universal or whoever, Netflix, they're in control. And part of that process is you're almost always in feature film going to be replaced by other writers. An executive who is not a writer is going to be assigned to your project and say, you know, I feel like we should raise the stakes in the third act, or there should be a ticking clock, or there should be this, or like, I feel like this character is not likable enough. They give these sort of pat notes and then they bring another writer in, and then the other writer is trying to address these notes. And maybe there's 5 or 6 writers, maybe there's 10 writers. Most feature films have many, many writers and a lot of cooks in the kitchen. Now, Christopher Nolan, he's making things himself. He writes it, directs it, it's his own thing. He's an auteur. But if you're talking about most movies, there's a lot of different writers, there's a lot of different producers. And then in the actual filming of it, you've got the director doing what they're going to do. The actors are going to, they're all people. So people are making the contributions and it's either going to get, you know, better or worse. And you don't have any control of a situation if you were the original writer because you're long gone and it's been given over to some other people. So when movies don't turn out great, it's because there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen. And it's not that we have a saying, no one sets out to make a bad movie. No one's trying to make it bad. But if you have 20 people all arguing about what the direction is, and the people who are paying the money are saying, let's listen to this person, not this person, the producer's fighting with the actor, and the actor's got their own ideas, a lot of people can mess it up. That's the feature film business. So that's why it's a miracle when feature films wind up turning out good. TV business is very different because you have a writer and producer who's the showrunner of the show that's guiding the process with their own vision. Usually it's the creator of the show that is also the showrunner. It doesn't have to be, but they're guiding the vision of the show. If you look at The Good Place, You know, Michael Shore, he creates the show. He's running the show the whole way, all four seasons, got a vision of where it's going, beginning, middle, and end of the seasons and of the whole show. I think where those shows, there's still things that can go wrong with producers and actors and whatever. I think where a TV show can go wrong is if the writer has not figured out where it's going to end. Usually when you are pitching a show, you know how it's going to go in the next season or how it's going to end. If it's a serialized story, if it's like Lost or The Night Agent or something like that, if it's just even The Good Place has a serialized ending, he probably knew how it was going to end in the beginning. And that makes it easy to get. When we did No Good Dick, we knew what the last episode, we said, here's the first episode, here's the last episode, here's what we think we're going to do in the middle. But if you don't know what the last episode is, it's hard to make you can of course course correct and make changes, but if you don't know where it's going, it's hard to make a coherent story. So that is usually the problem with a series falling apart, is when you don't know where it ends, or sometimes it goes for so many seasons that you planned on it being three seasons and then they want seven and now it's you're stretching it out and you've lost sight of the ending or whatever. There's things that can go wrong, but it's less often going to go wrong because you usually have one person that's guiding the whole series.
Interesting. You know, I was doing some research for this interview before we got on the call. I was doing my research on screenwriting and yourself as well. And one very interesting thing that I read was that there are three C's of screenwriting: character, conflict, and right. So first of all, do you agree with that? And second, if you had to pick one to compromise on, which one would it be?
Well, this is a great example of what I was talking about in the beginning, about how no one really knows exactly like how to do Hollywood, because I'd never heard that before.
Oh.
I was like, the three C's of, okay, great. I'm like, I wonder what those are going to be. And I was like, oh, character, sure, that's a good one. What was it? Yeah. Good to have a good concept. Those are all good. Those are three good things. Are those the only, if I was making up my own thing, would there be three of them? I don't know. Could I think of a fourth one that starts with C? Maybe. I'd never heard that there's those three things. It's not like a rule of Hollywood. So I'm not sure. And not to say that it's wrong. It sounds perfectly reasonable. But like, there is no like, as everyone knows, the three C's, no one's ever heard of that before. And like, people, you know, have different theories about like what makes a good story. So anyways, I never heard of that. They all sound like great things. You're saying if I had to pick one of them to throw out the window, it's not character. That's the most important one. Conflict is, you know, what gives you your comedy and your dramatic tension and whatever. I mean, I guess it doesn't have to be a great concept. It can just be like, you know, like what's the concept of The Office? You know, it's like a bunch of characters in a room and there's conflict, but there's not really a conflict. I mean, they're filming it. That's not much of a concept. So I would say concept, although important, is the least important of those two, of those three.
Very interesting. And another fun question that I thought of was, if there is I feel like I have so many questions and Karthik and I right now are just fighting for time to ask questions.
No, I can say
it's because what I do is a mystery. No one knows what people do in writing for Hollywood. It's like, I don't even know what we do. The whole thing's a mystery.
Yeah, I can sit and talk to you for 3 hours and we'll not run out of questions, I think.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of a door that's opening to something like, you know, there's TV, but there's so much that goes behind the scenes and it's very interesting to learn. Is there a movie that you saw this year that you thought, wow, I wish I had written that?
All the time, sure. Barbie.
Oh.
I mean, I thought Barbie was fantastic. It was like, because it was very next level. The comedy was very like fresh. But it was like, it's like surprising at every turn. And I think that's the most important thing, is that you're not going for what the expectation is. It's just constantly doing surprising plot twists and whatever. And that's what made it so funny and also had such an emotional accord to it. That's a great example. Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. That was last year, but that was like one that really blew me away. Nimona came out on Netflix. It's an animated film based on the graphic novel that I didn't create the graphic novel, so I couldn't have created the movie, but such a good movie. There's so many things that I wish I was involved with. Shrinking, I thought was such a well-done series. You said about movies, but I mean, all the time I watch things that I'm jealous of. There's things that I'm like, this is really, really well done, and I'm so impressed with it, but I don't wish I had done it because it's just not something I would have done, like The Bear. The Bear, as a TV show, I felt season two was really fantastic, even better than season one, but I wasn't like, oh, I wish I wrote The Bear, because I'm like, I'm not going to write that. I don't know anything about cooking, and it's like just people like cooking, and like the conflict is just like, you know, about dicing the onions the right way. It's like, I don't wish I'd written that at all. I respect it, but it's fine for someone else.
It's meant to, yeah.
Yeah, like the other things that are just not in my genre. Like, I thought The Diplomat was fantastic. The Diplomat with Kerry Russell was so good. And the whole way I'm like, how do they know so much about this stuff? It's like they're constantly talking like, you need to talk to the DI7 cartoon and blah, blah, carcoon. And it's just all this stuff that would have required so much research. And I was like, I don't know what they're talking about, but it sounds great.
Yeah.
It's another fun question. Now that you talk about Novel and Nimona coming out of it, if you had to adapt a novel or a book into a screenplay, which one would it be?
Well, I read a lot of graphic novels, so I'd love to do some graphic novels. There's some ones that I probably haven't heard of that are like not super popular. But sometimes my wife and I, we write together. Sometimes we try to adapt novels. We have a project at Disney that's based on The Anybodies, which is a series of three regular novels for middle school, middle grade novels, that's about a secret society of shapeshifters that is in development at Disney. We'd love to have that one get greenlit. It's been sitting there like, are they going to make this or not? So that's something that we would love to do. And we don't always create original things. Sometimes they're adaptations. We have a pitch before the strike started that's based on a graphic novel about some werewolves and go with those details. But a lot of things we do, because when you've been doing it for a long, long time, it's hard to always come up with original concepts. Sometimes you're adapting books, graphic novels, articles. We do anything that looks like a fun idea. In fact, we just wrote a short story, which we hopefully after the strike can sell the short story, then adapt it into something.
So how different is the process of adapting something? Is it your interpretation that comes in between? So just trying to understand how it is for an original idea that you had versus an adapted book that you're adapting.
Well, when you're doing something original, you're writing it with an eye towards whether it's film or television. You know what your medium is, so you're creating the idea and the in a way that's filmable and in a way that's visual. It's a visual medium. If you have a novel that you're like, oh, this would make a great story, but there's so much internal monologue, it's like people thinking. Novels are describing people's thoughts and describing rooms. Like I said, I read graphic novels. I'm not a huge novel reader because it hurts my brain, because when I write screenplays, you write in the present tense and novels are usually in the past tense, and it's hard to go back and forth. But one thing I'm always like, when you read the classic novels, it's like, wow, they're spending like so much time just describing what the room looks like. You know, it's like two pages of just, okay, we get it. It's like a certain type of wood on this desk. And I'm just thinking like production designer set deck, we'll just bring it a desk and we'll be like, yeah, that desk looks fine. So a lot of adapting a novel is trying to take what's internal and make it external and make it visual. If it's a lot of thinking, that's going to be problematic. If it's the other thing, maybe it's obvious if you're a screenwriter, but it's not obvious if you're a novelist, is that it's very, very difficult to write scenes, whether it's film or television, with one person in a room. You typically have to have two people, because unless they say things out loud, the audience is going to be like, oh, what is that person thinking when they look like, you know, like, what does that mean? They need to speak in order for the audience to understand them. And I don't know if it's your pet peeve. I don't like when people talk out loud to themselves. I think it's like a cheat. And voiceover is, you can use it a little bit, but it's also like a cheat. You can get away with it, but like, you don't want to have a person in a room just like narrating the story. The problem is that every screenwriter has all the time is like, okay, how can I get my character into a situation with someone else so that they can be talking out loud so the audience can understand what's going on? Whereas if you're a novelist, you don't even think about that, because you're like, okay, person's in a room and they're like, this is a scary situation. You know, I hear this wind is howling and like the blackness of the sky, it's freaking me out. I'm getting so worried. But it's like, I can't write a scene like that. So it has to be two people typically. And like, how do you get those two people together? So that's a very specific problem. It's things like that when you're adapting that you think about, is something written for a different medium has to be translated to our medium of film and entertainment. It's graphic novel. You know, graphic novels are static. Ours has motion. So it's that translation process. It creates a lot of problems.
So that's very interesting. I feel like it really opened the doors to so many things. There's so many technicalities that go into writing. Sometimes you just think that you sit down and you write a story. It's not really that. There's so much thought that goes into it, research that goes into it for the specific subject and everything.
Everyone thinks that they can write. Everyone's like, oh, I could do that if I just had the time.
Yeah.
And I've got my other job. But if I just had time, I could do what he's doing.
Yeah.
You can write a story. It's so easy.
Yeah.
But you don't realize I've been doing this for 25 years and I've accumulated 25 years of knowledge about how to do it, but no one knows what that knowledge is. And they're like, well, what does it mean? Like, how are you a better writer than you used to be? Isn't it all just the same? Can't anyone do it? Because it's hard to explain. And I feel like I'm actually doing a good job with examples to show you what the knowledge base is that a person who's just trying to break into the business doesn't have yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think your examples are also teaching like the dumbest person in the room, like me, about what it takes, right? I'm usually in all of these interviews, we're talking to experts and I'm like the dumbest person who doesn't understand. So your examples are really speaking to me. But thank you. This has been a great conversation. So thank you for sitting down with us and talking to us.
Yeah, this was a masterclass for me, you know, about screenwriting and filmmaking. And we have a mini series that we do at the EITF, a project called The Next Wave. And we would just love to have you as a guest and just pick your brain on different aspects of screenwriting and what goes into the process and whatnot.
Sure. I don't know what that is, but we can talk about it.
Yeah. But before we end the interview, there are two questions I want to ask. Usually there's only one, but this time we're putting a little bit of a twist on it.
Okay.
The first one is the question that we ask everyone else at the end of the interview, which is, what is your definition of success?
That's a really great question. I love that because it has changed dramatically over the years. Because I think that in my business, there is this built-in sort of hierarchy of fame, right? That doesn't necessarily, I mean, some industries have it, but you know, you're not necessarily going to be a famous dentist. Like, oh my God, you're the best dentist in the world. Whereas in Hollywood, there's like the top writer and the top producer, the top actor, like the A-list of everything. Yeah. So it's very hierarchical, and the money and the power goes with it, because people who have that are at the top of their game, not just make a lot of money, but they can get things made. They can walk into the studio, Tom Cruise, and say like, I want to make Mission Impossible 8 and I want $300 million to do it. And they're like, yes, sir, here's your $300 million. I can't do that. So he has more power than me. So I used to think when I was breaking in that success was about getting up that mountain as high as you could get. Maybe I'm never going to get to be Tom Cruise. I mean, if I'm not an actor anyway, but like whatever the top writer in the business is, making the most money, getting the most things, Shonda Rhimes, or, you know, whatever. That is not my definition anymore. That's what I thought we were trying to do, is climb the ladder of success and power and money. What I've learned in doing this for so long is that the definition of success is to keep doing it and to not be forced out of the business by a lack of success. I mean, I guess that's an inelegant way of saying it. The point is to keep doing it year after year and make enough money to continue to pay the bills. Sometimes I have great years. Sometimes I get a show on the air. Sometimes we don't work at all. And sometimes we have bad years. And we're just trying to get the next show. We're trying to get the next movie. But the fact that we're still in the game and like after 25 years, we're still being paid to write is the success story. And when we're all on strike now, when you walk on the picket line and you meet all these other writers, you realize the more mature writers have the same attitude. It's just like there's ups and downs. So much of it is out of your control. It's not a reflection on you as a writer, your mistakes or your bad decisions. It's just so much luck is involved. If things had just gone a little bit differently, you could have been, you know, 100 times more successful. And if things had gone a little bit different, you could have never broken in the first place and never even sold the first thing. And you could have gone off to some other career and never broken in. It's just a lot of random things happen. Yes, of course, there's talent involved and there's relationships and there's all these other skill sets that are important, but there's a lot of luck. And so the fact that I can keep earning enough money to get our health insurance and stay in the Writers Guild and keep doing it year after year, I feel very lucky.
That's a great answer. Like, I think it can be adapted even to other industries, right? Even in tech, for example, just putting one foot in front of the other and still working on the latest technology or any technology for that matter. That's the biggest success. That's a great and a very unique answer from what Karthik and I have heard so far. And one last question that I'm going to ask you. What is one question that you would like to ask our next expert? You don't know who it is, but this is kind of like the format that we're doing it in, career development. So what is one question that you want to ask the next person? And we will definitely ask them.
I guess the one thing that we don't have in my line of business is career stability. Do you feel like in your career that you have a sense of security that you're going to be able to keep doing it for the rest of your life? Like until you choose to retire, do you feel like you're going to be doing this for the rest of your life? If you want to. I mean, you could change careers, but if you want to keep doing this, do you feel like that is something that's within your power to control? Because it's certainly not in our industry. Like I could say, oh, I'd love to keep doing this the rest of my life. It's not up to me. Someone else is going to decide whether I'm done doing this. But in other fields, I'm just wondering if you feel like you have that career security and stability. And if you do you feel like you take that for granted?
Very interesting. Very, very. Now I'm wondering what that person is going to answer to this. Okay. Very interesting. Well, thank you so much. much, Steven. I will definitely put your question forward to our next expert. And thank you for joining us on the show. We learned so much. I mean, we're not going to become screenwriters immediately.
But that's exactly what I'm trying. That is the best hint that I'm trying to convey to the people watching this. Don't try to do this.
Yeah, but there's definitely a lot of information here that I think people can take away from this interview. So thank you. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having us
so much.